Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 26 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the children's novelist and playwright Anne Coburn speaks with Conor McPhee about her writing life, the challenges of travelling theatre, and her faith in the future of reading. Anne Coburn is a novelist and playwright. Her fiction for younger children includes the Dream Team series, and her novel Glint for older readers won an Arts Council Writers' Award and a Northern Writers' Award. Anne has written a number of award-winning plays which have been performed widely by touring theatre and are also published by Oberon Books. She runs schools workshops, mentors new writers, and tutors on the Creative Writing MA at Newcastle University. Anne's work has a strong sense of place, grounded in the landscape, history and mythology of North Northumberland and the Borders, where she now lives. Anne, perhaps you could start by telling us how you came to be a writer.
I've always written, actually, from being very, very young. I remember when I was 4 years old, my gran who lived with us, she was a bit of a formidable woman. She had arms like steel hawsers, and she used to send me to the corner shop to buy the bread and so on. And she'd say, you know, use the pennies to get some sweets. But I never did. I used to buy those notebooks, the little red ones. I think they're called Silver Seal. And then I would write in them just loads of loops and scrawls. It didn't make any sense. I was pretending to write. You know, it's the writing down was the important thing. And then I would tell my friends and anyone who would listen stories. So I've always written. But I started writing when I got my first teaching job and rediscovered teenage and children's fiction. When I was young myself, there was children's fiction, but then there was a big gap. And you would go on to read somebody like John Steinbeck. And while I was growing up, that changed. So when I started teaching, I discovered all this wonderful fiction. So that's what I decided I was going to write. But the very first thing I wrote was a competition for Woman's Own, which was a short story. I put the story in for a competition, didn't win it, but they wanted to publish it. And I used the money from that to buy my very first typewriter. And that's when I started writing. And I wrote my first children's book on that typewriter.
Did you set out to write fantasy for children, or did that kind of fiction sort of sneak up and grab you from behind?
I think I just wrote about what interested me. And I've always loved that kind of fantasy fiction, myths, legends, fairy tales, and I just kind of tapped into that tradition.
And when it comes to your books, are you a planner or a leaper? What's your process like?
When I wrote my first book, The Granite Beast, it took me about 4 years, partly because I was teaching at the same time, but partly because I was just sitting there trying to write it without any planning at all, and kept making mistakes and having to backtrack. And so then when I wrote my second book, I planned it to the last detail and very nearly killed it, actually, because I was just so bored. Once I started writing, you know, there was nothing left to explore, there was nothing left to discover. So now I've got a kind of happy medium. If you imagine a plot as a washing line, and I have key scenes that I peg onto that, and those are the scenes I'm writing towards. They're usually like the standout scenes, they're very visual, they are there at particularly strong plot points. And I write towards them and between them. That's the way I work. I don't have huge character histories or anything like that.
So it sounds like there's still some room for you to be surprised as you're going along by
because
things that happen.
Exactly, because there's that chemistry. I don't know what to call it. Magic? I don't know. There's something there that when you're writing, you find things you weren't expecting to find. And I think every writer has to leave space for that, as well as giving themselves a puzzle to solve each morning when they get up and have to sit down at the word processor. You know, you have to have something to make you want to go and do that. So I always try and finish the night before with a question for me.
As a writer for younger people, do you feel you have any particular moral or didactic duties, or is it simply storytelling?
There's a danger, I think, if you're writing for children and young adults, there is a danger in issue writing and allowing that to overtake the story. So for me, the story is the thing. I think if you want to make a point, you write a pamphlet. Having said that, there is a kind of a moral duty, I think, there in particularly children's writers, maybe not so much teenagers, because I still remember how intensely books affected me at that age. And often children, there are a lot of first times for children. they're experiencing something very intensively for the first time. So there is a duty there, I think, to not write for sensationalism, to write honestly, to write with as much emotional truth as you can. Other than that, I don't believe in writing for children being a teaching tool.
Yeah, I'm reminded of books that I read as a child that were heartbreakingly moving. How far would you go with grief, for example, in writing for children? How far would you take them into that? Is there a point at which you draw back and say, no, that's just too emotionally painful for a child to have to process?
I don't think it's anything you can't deal with, and it's the way that you deal with it is a thing, because I have picture books at home dealing with depression and with death. Michael Rosen's Sad Book, for instance, or Sean Tan, The Red Tree. So, you know, they're picture books and they're dealing with big, difficult issues. It's the way that you write it is a thing. So if you're dealing with a difficult subject such as violence, you have to write it in a way that the child only understands as much as their understanding is prepared to take. It's a difficult thing to describe, but I think if you read the opening passage of The Graveyard Book by Neil Gaiman, that is a scene where this child's whole family is murdered. And when you read it as an adult, it's horrific. But a child could read that and only take what they understand from it. There's no mention of blood. There's a mention of a knife, but there's no mention of blood on the knife.
It sounds like you yourself read a great deal as a child. So when you're writing, is it that child self of your own that you have in mind as the audience for the books, or are you consciously writing for today's children, so to speak?
I think it's both. I think children's lives have changed, but the basic humanity, the basic state of being human hasn't. So in a sense, it's both. I'm writing for the child I remember, and writing for today's children, because all those things, all those first times, the first kiss, the horribly embarrassing situation, all of those things still happen. They may happen differently. And in fact, there is an issue about privacy for today's children, I think, with Facebook. You know, you can't make your mistakes in private anymore. But it basically hasn't changed that much, I don't think.
I mean, on that theme, there's a lot of gloom and doom talk about young people's shrinking attention spans and the imminent death of reading and things like that. Is there any substance to any of that, do you think?
Well, I think that children are reading less, but we still have our core of children who love to read. And we're kind of responding to it. You know, children's books are morphing into different things. So there's a much more of a cross-cultural thing going on between picture books and graphic novels and books for children and books for young adults. A lot of books for young adults are now highly illustrated, for instance, in a graphic novel style. A lot of picture books are dealing with very big topics. So I think we're kind of changing to accommodate that, but not in a bad way. And of course, you know, children are like adult readers. You've got the ones who love to read just what's the equivalent of popcorn films in books, you know, to read that kind of story, and children who love to read very literary work. And, you know, that range of work is still there for them.
So would multimedia type writing be something that would interest you in the future?
I'd have to learn about it first. I'm a little bit of a Luddite on that one. But yes, I mean, I've just written a book of fairy tales for historic royal palaces, and I know that that will in the future be turned into an app. I'm not even sure what that is, but it is an interesting one with this multi-platform thing where children can become involved quite actively, and they can go off and do different things about that book or to do with that book. I think it's a new way of doing an old thing, because if you think about oral storytelling and storytellers and audiences and how that changes and how the storyteller would adapt to the audience and how the audience will respond in different ways, although it feels new, it's an old tradition.
You know, I sometimes have to remind my kids and sometimes myself that our generation grew up without mobile phones or computer or the internet. And, you know, I sometimes worry that our obsessive use of technologies to stay connected, often in quite trivial ways, all the time, is maybe damaging our ability to be alone, and maybe that has a knock-on effect on our ability to be good readers.
There is that pressure all the while, but for me, I think that children would seek out reading as a refuge even more than they used to. So it's there for them if they need it. I'm a bit of an optimist rather than a pessimist on this one, I have to say, because I do visit schools a lot. I visit book festivals. I see children who are so enthusiastic about particular authors or particular books. So it may have shrunk slightly, the audience, I don't know, but it's still out there and there are still children who are wonderful readers.
It's a lovely, encouraging thought, isn't it? Mm. Reading as a refuge from all of that technology, as a way to actually shut down that constant bombardment from the outside.
It is a bombardment, you're right. I would hate to be a child today. I really would.
I certainly notice that it's much harder for children to get away from their social world now. You know, in our day, you could go to school, but then you could come home and be away from it. Whereas if you have a mobile phone with Facebook and things like that all the time, it's there.
Yes.
So, you know, if you're being bullied or you know, having a hard time at school, it must be almost unbearable not to be able to get away from that.
Mm, that's right. Patrick Ness's Chaos Walking trilogy, he deals with that lack of privacy for today's teenagers. It's actually a dystopian novel, but he's dealing with it because he feels that it's a big threat. The lack of privacy in growing up, the lack of privacy to be able to make your mistakes and move on is worrying, I agree.
I was reading an interview recently with Ursula Le Guin, and she was describing the pressure that she'd come under with her most recent fantasy novels to make them more like Harry Potter. And I thought to myself, good grief, you know, if they can't see the difference between a Wizard of Earthsea and a Wizard of Hogwarts, where is the world heading? Do you think that children's and young adults' fantasy is becoming narrower as a result of perhaps misguided commercial pressure?
I think that children's publishers are still the gentlemen of the publishing industry, if you like. They're very, very committed to quality. My publisher, Walker Books, publish a fantastic range of fantasy and none of it Harry Potter-ish. So I do think there's still a hallmark and a quality standard out there. The pressure, I think, is possibly from movies, from films. You know, if you're thinking about the Twilight series or Harry Potter, not that I think Harry Potter is a bad book, there is a pressure from that side of the industry to fit into a genre that's popular at the moment. And there are books that are doing that, but I still think there's room for diversity and quality writing out there.
In terms of your own writing, if you are asked to make changes to fit a sort of marketing brief, are there certain lines that you wouldn't cross? Are there sort of red flags for you?
If we go back to that not writing to be sensational and that emotional truth, that honouring your reader, that would be the sign for me if there were an ending that didn't fit with the book or a false ending in some way, I would not be prepared to go there. I have been asked once to change, for the Japanese market, a minor character in my Dream Team series was killed, and they felt that would be too much for their young readers. And I thought about that a lot, and I thought, OK, I will change it. And it actually worked out better, because when I got to the end of that series of books, and I was writing the last one in the series, the villain who had caused that minor character to die is sort of redeemed. I don't want to give too much away, but he is sort of redeemed. And I realised as I was writing that last book, the eighth book in the series, that if I hadn't changed what happened to that minor character in the fifth book, he would not have been able to be redeemed as he was. So actually that one worked out well for me, you know, and I subsequently changed it for the UK publication as well. So that was something I was prepared to go along with. But I think that would be the baseline for me. If it's not emotionally true, I wouldn't do it.
Well, I've seen that your Dream Team books are going to be made into a film. If they wanted to change the ending, how would you feel? Would you go along with that?
I'm not writing the screenplay, so it's a little bit out of my hands what they do with it. I'm not actually sure how much say I would have in it, to be honest. As long as it's not my books they're interfering with, I see that as a totally different thing and not particularly to do with me. My books are the genesis of it. So I'm not saying I would be happy about it, but I'm just leaving that up to them. I think it's probably too stressful to get involved any further than that. So that would be fine by me, yes.
Is this the first of your books that have been turned into films?
Well, I should say it's only been optioned, but it is. Yes, it's the first and only one that option has been taken out on, yeah.
That must be quite exciting then.
Well, it is sort of exciting, but it is a question of not believing it's going to happen, because 90% of these things don't happen. So it's kind of something that, oh, that's rather good, and then you put it away in a cupboard and leave it, you know.
So, Anne, you've written plays as well as novels, including plays for adults. Mm. Did you have to change the way you write in any substantial way to make that transition?
Oh, yes, it's very different. In fact, the first play I wrote was a play for adults called Get Up and Tie Your Fingers about the Eyemouth fishing disaster. And I made all the mistakes that a beginner playwright makes. So it's very story-led, it's word-based. Luckily, it worked out because these women who lived in these fishing villages are natural storytellers. But since then, I've learned an awful lot about being visual, about the text only being part of it. And so it's very, very different way of writing, although I do think I'm a visual writer as a children's writer, so it wasn't that hard a transition. I love the contrast, the two different ways of writing. You know, I like to do a play and a book in a year, and I like moving between one and the other because the difference keeps me lively, keeps me alert, keeps me interested. And, of course, writing plays, you're not producing the finished article. You're producing a draft which you then work on with directors and actors, which I absolutely love doing. They all bring their input, a very big input into it, actually. It's much more of a collaborative process, whereas when you're writing a book, everything's down to you. You have to get everything right yourself. So, yes, it's different, but equally enjoyable, I think.
Is there as much room to be fantastical in a play, or do the constraints of staging somehow limit the sort of worlds that you might create?
As long as you're not trying to be literal and realistic, you can do anything you want on a stage. The theatre group I work with has had people downhill skiing, using escalators, flying, all of it without any props or mechanical devices whatsoever. It's just purely physical theatre and the actors themselves. You can create virtually anything you want on stage. It requires a commitment from the audience as well, you know, a suspension of disbelief, preparedness to say, oh yes, look, there's a flying cloud that looks like a dragon, which is what we did once. It's not as limitless as radio, where they always say you can have thousands of butterflies taking off from a field. You can't do that on stage. You can create enough of an image of it for the audience to go, oh, I see what that is. I would say don't limit yourself. I always write what I want to happen on the stage, and then the director will tell me if that's impossible, and I'll go away, you know, and be a bit grumpy about it for a bit and then come back with a revised version.
I guess working with touring theatre companies too, who have to be in and out in a night, it must constrain what they can do with staging, perhaps in a fruitful way. You know, constraints often are helpful for the creative process, I find.
Yes, I agree. You know, it's this magic out of a box, really. So they'd see it not as a constraint, it's a challenge, and it keeps things simple, because there is a danger in becoming too involved in the mechanics of something and building a bigger and bigger and more complex set. Whereas if you have to be touring, everything has to be down to the basics.
It must be a tremendous experience being on the road with a touring theatre company, very different from the novelist sitting in the garret doing their solitary work.
Yeah, it's scary, to be honest, because the reaction is so immediate. The first night is horrendous. You know, you sit there in the audience and you just know straight away whether this play is working or not by the reaction of the audience. So it's very unlike writing, where the reviews start to trickle in slowly and you can read one and dismiss it because you say, oh, that's only the view of one person. You know, if a whole audience is sitting there and they're starting to shuffle or whatever, you know this is not quite as successful as your last play. Alternatively, if it's going down well, it's the best feeling in the world. I remember when we did the first night of Get Up, Tie Your Fingers, actually in Eyemouth, which is the town where the disaster happened, on the anniversary of the disaster. I don't know why we thought this was a good idea.
No pressure, yeah.
No, exactly. The hall was full and I was sitting in the audience, and there was a very emotional scene where the three women, the mother, the daughter and the friend, you know, they've all lost men in the disaster. And the hall was absolutely silent. And then a man in the audience started whistling through his teeth, like this. And I thought, oh no, he must be so bored. And then his wife came up to me in the interval and said, I must apologise for my husband. He does that when he gets emotional. So, oh, thank goodness, you know, that was okay. But yes, it can be terrifying. Absolutely, because it's so immediate.
Have you ever had a play which wasn't going down well where you thought, gosh, I have to change this before the next night? You know, do you try and resurrect it in some way if it doesn't go well?
I think that you can tweak. If you know that a speech has gone on too long, or, you know, there's a particular plot change that might not be working, you can tweak. But at that stage, it's too late, really. It's too late to do anything because, you know, you've had 3 weeks of rehearsal. That's when all the changes should have happened. You can't really expect a theatre group who are on the road putting a play on every night to then start accepting major changes in the script. So, no, I'm afraid by the time it's on the road, that's it.
Live drama is almost unique in that, isn't it? I mean, even with the cinema, you know, the director doesn't get that sense of immediacy except from test screenings, I suppose. You know,
that's
you really
right.
are on the spot
yes.
with your audience's reaction.
Yes.
It's very humbling, yeah.
It's humbling and it makes for a very fast learning curve. You know, when you write the next play, you've learned an awful lot from the last one.
So one of your popular children's series is The Dream Team. Speaking of dreams, do they figure significantly in your creative life?
Hardly at all, but sleep is important. I know that I go to bed sometimes with what seems like an intractable problem in a book or a play. And as I'm waking up in the morning, it's there. The answer's there. I don't know what's happened during the night. I can't remember what's happened. I remember when I was writing Get Up and Tie Your Fingers, I woke up knowing that the thematic imagery running through that play would be the Northern Lights. I don't know how it came to me, but it came to me when I was asleep. I don't remember the dream. So it's not so much dreams, but I do think something happens to your brain when it's turned off, when it's not awake, that's important for creativity.
It's marvellous, isn't it? I mean, I often say that to students. Give yourself space if you're working on an essay or something like that. Give yourself space to sleep during the process because
yes.
your brain will do the work in the background, a lot of it for you. It's remarkable,
yes.
isn't it?
It is.
Do you sleep a lot?
I sleep well. Yes. I've never had problems sleeping. I don't nap during the day or anything like that. It's just that often I wake up and it's there, the answer's there. It's a very strange process. Often your conscious mind can be negative, it can block. There are things that come in about fear of the empty page and worries about whether it's going to be as good as the last one, which perhaps disappear when you're asleep.
Do you find if you don't get enough sleep that your creativity drops off?
That's true, actually. When my children were very young and I would be trying to write on very little sleep, it really didn't go well. I don't know whether it's partly this lack of sleep, it's partly the fragmentary nature of the time you can concentrate on the writing, because certainly in the early stages when I'm still thinking through things, there's an awful lot of just sitting staring into space and thinking before I start writing, and that does tend to get disrupted when you've got young children.
Well, the threat of interruption all the time is very hard,
yeah.
isn't it, if you're you know, a writer that likes to concentrate and get lost in what you're doing.
Exactly, yes. But then strangely enough, when I was pregnant, it was two of the most creative periods I can remember. It just kind of poured out of me, you know.
So why don't you have 20 children? On a slightly tangential point, is it true that you lived for a whole year on jam sandwiches?
Apparently. It's not something I particularly remember. It was when I was three. I just wouldn't eat nothing but jam sandwiches.
Any particular jam?
Strawberry. My mother was in despair. It had to be white bread and it had to be butter and it had to be strawberry jam. And that's what I would eat. But she very sensibly just left me to it, I think. And I grew out of it, luckily.
And here you are in fine fettle, yes.
Yeah.
Not a good example to your young readers.
No,
I'm
absolutely
sure.
not. But
we
it was.
Won't mention that.
But it was a good example of parenting. Because if you try and force things on a child, it doesn't work. Actually, that's quite a good lesson in writing for children as well, thinking about it.
And did you really once set fire to the house?
I did, yes. This was in the days of coal fires and clothes horses. My mum had gone upstairs and left my sister and I, she thought, safely, just for a few minutes, and the clothes horse was in front of the fire with loads of sheets and everything on it. And I just decided that it would be better if they were in the fire. So I put all the sheets and washing into the fire, plus my old teddy bear, which I still have, who's still slightly bald as a result of it. And they all caught fire and the rug caught fire. And by the time my mum came downstairs, it was pretty well ablaze. I don't remember what happened after that. Presumably she put it out.
Poor Ted.
I know.
There's some psychodrama there. So finally, what does a good day look like to you?
A good writing day is not about the number of words I've written. It's whether I've captured exactly what I wanted to get. It's that feeling of, how can I describe it? It's like flicking a crystal glass with your finger and that chime that you get, that ring, that tone. If that's there anywhere in what I've produced that day, I'm happy. It's just that silvery tone, you know? It's pure and it's clear. And that's the same whether I'm writing fiction or whether I'm writing drama.
Anne Coben, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
That was Anne Coben in conversation with Kona McPhee. You can find out more about Anne on her website at www.annecoben.com. That's Anne with no E. And that concludes episode 26, which was recorded and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 27, the poet Jane Draycott speaks with Julia Copus about her modern translation of Pearl, the great medieval poem of earthly loss and spiritual consolation. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.